From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Sunset.
University Park North.
Glen Park.
Lake Merritt.
The West Portal neighborhood.
NOPA.
Coming up, how teaching immigrant parents English can help the educational experience of their kids.
We teach them like, okay, what do you do when you call in for an absence for your child? You have to call it in, so they have to be able to express that in English.
Then a peek into what happens to all those letters written to Santa.
Dear Santa Claus, will you please bring me a few presents? I want a teddy bear, a piano, a box of paints.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
The fog here has a beauty all its own as it drifts and billows in from the sea, thick and sunny.
And so this sequence was shot in 64.
Lost and Found. That's today on Cross Currents. Usually, education stories start with a classroom full of kids. Well, today, we're going to do something a little different and bring you a classroom full of parents.
I want
to learn
English.
Yes,
I want to learn English.
All of these parents have limited English. They're refugees, asylum seekers, and recent immigrants who have settled in the East Bay. And these classes they're in are part of a greater educational trend, taking on the needs of some parents in order to help their children succeed in school, too. KALW's Hannah Kingsley-Ma is here to say more. And just a note, some people in the story are being identified by their first names only in order to protect their privacy.
Okay, ready?
Ready.
Why are you way over there?
In a sun-filled classroom at Oakland International High School, four women, most of them wearing hijabs, cluster around a whiteboard, gripping fly swatters in their hands.
Hat!
They're playing a word match game. When the teacher calls out a word, the women have to locate it on the board and thwack it with the swatter. This is a free English language class offered by the nonprofit Refugee Transitions. Parents and relatives of kids in the Oakland Unified School District can sign up first.
One, two, three. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away.
The adult students in this class come from countries like Burma, Peru, Yemen, and China. Some have college degrees, and some never went to school. But they're all eager to learn, mostly for this reason.
I need to speak English for help my kids to make their homework. So I need to learn more English.
That's Francisca. She came to the U.S. from Guatemala and speaks Spanish and Mam, an indigenous Mayan language. Her kids attend Oakland schools, and she's cradling a baby in her arms. She's here to get involved in her kids' education. And Refugee Transitions built its curriculum around this desire.
So we teach them like, okay, what do you do when you call in for an absence for your child? You have to call it in, so they have to be able to express that in English.
That's Aisha Peñalosa. She's the teacher here.
And then also the big thing is parent-teacher conference.
Parent Francisca says at parent-teacher conferences, she now knows what questions to ask, like
how their behavior and what we can do it for them at home.
This idea that helping parents helps kids might seem like a no-brainer. Well, now there's evidence to back it up. In a report published this year, the Migration Policy Institute found that children of refugees do better academically when they are in an English-speaking family. Parents with lower language proficiency have a harder time finding stable jobs, getting health care. But they also struggle in advocating for their children and navigating institutions like schools.
Red. Orange. Yellow.
In a portable trailer at Franklin Elementary School, young mothers gather to learn the colors of the rainbow. This class is geared towards parents of little ones, which means that there's about 20 babies in the classroom and a hired babysitter to look after them.
So remember, we want to sing to our children. We want to talk to our children in Farsi, in Chinese, in English, in Arabic.
An added benefit of these classes is their ripple effect in the community. Mishkan is from Afghanistan. She used to be a student in this class, and now she works here.
Now I'm a helper with the other Afghan woman.
Translating for other students. Mishkan brings her little boy to school, a kid with a big toothy smile and a Spider-Man sweatshirt. With a little nudging, he launches into the alphabet. Mishkan's fluent enough to be able to help her son learn English, but that's not everyone's experience. Another woman, Garam, comes every week to support her mother and sister-in-law. She's 21, and like many immigrant kids, she grew up as a translator.
And I still do everything for them until this day. Going to the hospital, going to the store, doing their bank accounts.
When Garam moved here at age 8 from Yemen, her parents cared deeply about her education, but couldn't really help her directly because of the language barrier. Classes like this let parents participate in their children's education in ways Garam's weren't able to.
I wish there are more classes because a lot of people, especially those who just come from Yemen and try to learn English, they go almost literally everywhere in Oakland. They walk school by school just to find a class like this.
Many eager parents try to take these classes, but the group putting them on, Refugee Transitions, doesn't have enough resources to meet the high demand. There's a long waiting list. The Oakland Unified School District offers ESL family literacy courses too, but adult education programming took a big cut during the budget cuts after 2008, and the district had to scale back. Before, family literacy classes were offered in 26 schools. Today, it's 6. And the need is not just in Oakland. In the U.S., 8 million immigrants are parents of young children. And these parents are more likely to live in poverty. So while classes like this are here to teach people English, they can also help people get a better job and access services, as well as helping their kids in school. Garam says every day she gets a phone call from someone in her community asking about these classes.
Even my own sister, she just got a new baby. She wants to teach him everything the right way.
While I'm talking to Garam, I see something out of the corner of my eye. One small example of how these classes can impact the whole family. A middle school student wanders over from the nearby yard. He's just tall enough to peep inside the window, trying to get a glimpse of his mom at work at her desk before he heads off to class to do the same. In Oakland, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma for Cross Currents.
Are there specific education stories you'd like to hear reported? Email Hannah Kingsley Ma, our education reporter, at education@kalw.org. Welcome back to Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, in for Hanat Baba. Earlier this week, we talked about President-elect Donald Trump's threat to cut up to $1 billion of federal funding if San Francisco doesn't cooperate with national efforts to deport undocumented immigrants. Supervisor Aaron Peskin had this to say.
The government is united, all of the members of the board, the mayor of San Francisco, in sticking up for one of San Francisco's fundamental San Francisco values.
We asked for your opinions about San Francisco's sanctuary city status, and we received this call.
As a queer immigrant from the East Coast in the 80s, I came to San Francisco. At the time, there were lots of queer people coming to San Francisco from all over the country, many of whom came here from places they were treated really badly and beat up and ostracized and all that. And the AIDS epidemic really showed people we need to stay here and take care of each other because we don't have anyone else. I agree with Erin Peskin, this is a sanctuary city for all of us, from every background and every ideology, and we need to keep it that way.
Thanks, Mary. We'd like to hear the thoughts of other listeners on the sanctuary city topic. Please share yours at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane, and for Hanat Baba. Every year, post offices around the country are inundated with letters like these.
Dear Santa.
Dear Santa.
I want you to know I've been a very good girl for Christmas.
Can I have a surprise present, please?
That was recorded at the annual Christmas tree lighting at Pier 39 in San Francisco. It's part of a workshop hosted by the United States Postal Service where children can get help writing their letters to Santa Claus. The workshop is part of the Letters to Santa program, which for more than 100 years has helped volunteers grant children's Christmas wishes. KALW's Ted Muldoon and Jessica Plotchek decided to volunteer.
Dear Santa Claus, will you please bring me a few presents? I want a teddy bear, a piano, a box of paints, a box of tools, a sister, a chair, a pair of mittens. Merry Christmas to you. CB, December 20th, 1908.
As long as Santa has existed, kids have written letters to him, like that one.
Most of these letters would go unanswered. But 4 years after that letter was published in the San Francisco Call, back in 1912, the United States Postal Service introduced the Letters to Santa program to respond on Santa's behalf.
Before that program existed, it was technically illegal to open letters addressed to Santa.
That would get you on the federal naughty list. Wait, blacklist?
But this didn't stop vigilante postal workers.
It's rumored that this guerrilla philanthropy started in the bowels of the Dead Letter Office.
A place for letters without viable destinations.
Like to Santa Claus, North Pole. And that's it.
Other apocryphal tales tell of a wealthy bachelor answering Yuletide pleas.
Then in 1979, the Postal Service expanded the program to answer letters addressed to the Easter Bunny and Mother Nature.
By this time, Johnny Carson had spent every December for nearly two decades popularizing the Letters to Santa program on The Tonight Show.
Dear Santa and dear elves, thank you for bringing me the presents. When you mess up our floor, please try to clean up. Our Christmas tree is in the basement rec room this year. Don't worry. If you make noise, Dad said he won't go down and shoot you.
Before you judge this 80s kid, you may want to know that things haven't changed that much today.
What do you want from Santa?
A BB gun and a knife.
At the annual tree lighting at Pier 39 in San Francisco, we join hordes of kids drafting their own letters to Santa Claus. Wishes ranged from the cosmic.
Dear Santa, I want a telescope, one that can look into space.
To the more terrestrial.
I want a binder and paper. Also, I want money.
Everywhere, little tykes scribbled down their wish list in pidgin English.
The younger ones didn't write at all and just slammed stamps on the page.
Children are very, very inventive.
That's Augustine Ruiz, spokesperson for the Postal Service. Ruiz has been with the post office since 1984.
So every year, usually it starts around July and August, we start seeing these letters starting to trickle in, addressed to Santa Claus, North Pole, no address other than that.
Ruiz says the Bay Area alone gets close to 6,000 letters each holiday season. And what happens to those letters? Well, they get answered with the help of volunteers and postal workers, or postal elves, his words.
I would say the volunteers that we get throughout the Bay Area probably number in the hundreds, individuals and also companies.
Oh, they're all so cute.
Karen Shearer is one of the volunteers we found at the Hunters Point Post Office. The workers have set up a table in the entryway, covered in stacks of letters. Throughout the day, visitors stop by to sift through them, like Shearer.
Dear Santa, I'm 2 years old. For Christmas, I would like a bicycle. Kill me. It's got stamps all over it. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
How did you hear about it?
I was going to go hiking, but then my back hurt this morning, and so I was just scrolling on Facebook, and I thought, oh, Oh, this is so cute. I want to be Santa. And I love shopping, so it's perfect.
The kid's first name and age are really the only personal information left on the letters.
We give them a copy that has a number on it, and it has no identity of the child, no address.
They photocopy the originals and redact everything sensitive. Every letter gets a number so that they can match responses with the right destination.
And these letters, they're not all from children.
We get a lot of letters actually from mothers, single mothers, that are just trying to get the bare necessities for their children, just to get them through the holidays, because it's very hard for them.
As we page through the letters, there are tons of toys I have no clue about. Like Shopkins? No idea. But after a half hour, we narrow it down to 8 choices and sign them out.
Just tell me the numbers.
390, 94, 174.
Next stop, shopping!
At Target.
Yeah. That thing is pretty sweet.
If I was a kid, I would love that.
Okay, I need a bear.
In the end, we bought...
a bear.
A box of toy money.
A plush puppy.
A ninja Lego set.
Flying minions.
A chemistry set.
Elves.
And a gift card.
When we finished wrapping them, we brought them back to the post office and sent them off.
Now, some of these letters are impossible to shop for.
But we still have to answer them in the way Santa would.
Okay, rapid fire round Jessica. How would Santa respond? Did Santa invent Christmas?
No, but he's an avid supporter.
Would Santa say that?
Sorry, strong supporter.
Okay, can you grant world peace?
No, Santa cannot control children. Same goes for adults.
Okay, how about this one?
Dear Santa, for Christmas I want world peace. I bet you can do that. I wish every ISIS guy will be killed.
Okay, so let's look up how to talk to children about ISIS.
So, what did you come up with?
It's really long, but something basically like Santa cannot kill.
Not bad. I guess I wasn't expecting to feel so anxious about writing these letters. You feel unqualified and kind of creepy.
I feel like I should have been consulting with the parents.
I mean, it's the child's imagination and moral compass on the line here. What if I ruined Santa for some kid forever?
Okay, Ted, you're being dramatic. I had fun playing the kind and generous benefactor. It suits me.
Playing the wealthy bachelor never goes out of style.
And good thing. It's anyone's guess what they'll be asking for next year.
For Christmas, I want a hoverboard.
For KALW News, I'm Ted Muldoon.
And I'm Jessica Plachek.
Want to learn more about the Letters to Santa program? Head to our website, klw.org, click on Cross Currents.
I tell them all I want for Christmas is 2 gold front tees and 10 karat diamonds on a fat gold wreath that I can wear around my neck. Get money and respect. Tell Santa Claus to bring a $10 million check so I can spread a little cheer. Fly a couple leers.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Julie Kane and for Hanat Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
The fog here has a beauty all its own as it drifts and billows in from the sea, thick and silent.
And so this sequence was shot in 64 during the time of the Republican National Convention in San Francisco. And this is 1975.
Think you recognize that? To tell you more, we sent KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs to San Francisco's Castro Theater to meet up with Rick Prelinger, who describes himself as...
unconventional archivist of unconventional film material.
The fog here has a beauty all its own as it drifts and billows in from the sea, thick and silent.
Once a year, every December, I do Lost Landscape shows at the Castro.
It's great to see you here for the 11th time, unbelievably.
So Lost Landscapes is a bunch of things. In the most simple form, it's an assembly of footage showing historic San Francisco, footage that you wouldn't already have seen a million times. So it's a film screening, but it's an unusual film screening because it's participatory. Most of it is silent, and the audience makes the soundtrack.
Please identify people, places, and events. Ask questions. Engage in friendly disputes with your neighbors. And enjoy the next 72 minutes. Thanks so much.
Last year, I think the show was completely silent, and the audience made the soundtrack all the way. This year, we have something in the neighborhood of 8 minutes of sound. My arrangement is usually topographical, meaning that I enter the city. I like to begin with some kind of entry. The show actually begins and ends with some rather odd ideas about the fog.
Here the fog is seldom sinister or depressing, as you may know it elsewhere. Here the natives boast they have a special kind of fog that befits a special kind of city.
And then I take a path through town.
1939. It's magic hour on the ferry.
I walk around with a mic. I'm kind of an MC. I tell people what I know about footage. I identify it. Yeah, I talk a bunch.
1956. Still an active prison, of course. Sometimes in home movies, you can see inmates in the yards.
When did Alcatraz close?
62.
There's something magic and exciting about the possibility of being transgressive in a movie theater, breaking the rules, because you're not supposed to talk in the movies, right?
Our uncle was a fire department doctor, and he got us on the fire boat.
We have a huge home movie archives. You know, I've collected about 14,000 home movies of North America.
And this is footage that comes to us from Mary Coe, because it's her grandfather. Roland Croft, who's a dentist downtown and a member of the Dolphins.
One of the most wonderful things about Lost Landscapes, and one of the most wonderful things about working with home movies, is the change of scale. And by that I mean, when you look at home movies with your family, you're looking at a little screen. Maybe at most it's 4 by 5 feet. When you blow them up to the big screen of the Castro, this amazing transformation takes place, because the detail just jumps out.
And he's swimming the Golden Gate, along with some other people, before the bridge.
This is evidence. This is raw footage.
Not all of you are familiar with the Geary and Gough and Cathedral Hill area, but for those of you who are, this is a real glimpse of an alternate universe, because none of this is here anymore.
I'm not into the nostalgic part of urban history. Who wants to go back to the past, you know? Who wants to go back to a time that was even more unequal than it is now? I find, you know, the historical footage, it's poetic, it's beautiful, it's enigmatic, it's filled with detail that's endlessly fascinating. But just because it's fascinating doesn't mean it's a world I want to live in.
So this chained monkey has a human toy, which he's taking apart. It's only fair.
You know, these films are about the past, but the present always bleeds into them. Absolutely. This show made me quite interested about the 30s, about a time when San Francisco was a working people's town. There was a lot of social struggle, a lot of public assembly. I wanted to put that in the foreground.
36, these are the longshoremen, just won union recognition, then he showed up on Market Street as a show of strength. You can't mess with us.
There's a beautiful film about this man who works in the produce market going back home as the sun rises to meet his wife. But it's a time when, you know, you could have a working class job and have a house in San Francisco.
It's daylight by the time the last truck is unloaded, and a lumper knows by then he's done a good night's work. 60,000 pounds a night, 5 nights a week. That's my average, and I don't mind saying I'm proud of it.
When you get 1,400 people in a room, this is an amazing potential. What could we do? What could these 1,400 people do, you know, when they're not in the movie? I hope to motivate people to think about their own lives and their own community in a historical sense, not to be presentist. Things haven't always been the way that they are now, and they're not always going to be constantly changing. But also to really take an active part in thinking about what the city could be.
San Franciscans boast that their city has a moderate year-round temperature and the healthiest climate in the world. The fog banks which roll in from the Pacific are, San Franciscans say, merely invigorating sea mists, bringing health, wealth, and happiness to the wonder city of the West.
That was Rick Preylinger's Lost Landscapes at the Castro Theater in San Francisco. Our winner this week was Gene Finley. Congratulations, Gene. We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. Audiograph's going to be taking a two-week break for the holidays, but when we come back, we'll have a handful of all-new sounds for you to guess.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all.
And that's it for us today. Our team includes Josiah Luis Alderete, Leela Day, Nicole Grigg, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Cross Currents is taking a break for the holidays. You'll be hearing news from the BBC until we get back in the new year. A safe and happy holidays to all of you from all of us. For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.